I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 6th, and we have a lot to talk about. And before we get into today's episode, I feel like I owe a few thank yous. First, to more than 900 of you who've already taken our listener survey, thank you. Your feedback is helping me understand what you really like about Real Talk MS and what you'd like to hear more or less of. I'm keeping careful notes and spreadsheets and using just about every other tool that you might imagine to remind me of what you're looking for. And your feedback is shaping future episodes of this podcast. If you haven't yet taken the survey, I promise it's quick, and when you complete the survey, you'll be eligible to win a $100 Amazon gift card. So if you can spare about 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it if you head over to realtalkms.com/survey and share your opinion about the podcast. For the past several months, I've been saying that Real Talk MS reaches listeners in more than 90 countries around the world. And as our listener community has continued to grow, I've been watching that number of countries slowly inch up past 93, 94, 95, 96, then it hit 97, then it hit 98, and then, thanks to new listeners in Sri Lanka, Kazakhstan, and Guam, the Real Talk MS listener community now spans more than 100 countries around the world. I'm grateful and humbled that you choose to spend some of your time each week listening to this podcast. Your attention inspires me to make sure that your time is always well spent. More than half of all the people living with MS will develop some problems with cognition. And while experiencing cognitive dysfunction can be challenging and frustrating, these kinds of changes can also be frightening. And the really scary thing about MS-related cognitive decline is that it isn't always something that gets addressed during that six-month or yearly check-in with your neurologist. Joining me to talk about MS-related cognitive dysfunction and some of the things that you can do to better manage cognitive changes and preserve healthy cognition is neuroscientist and neuropsychologist Dr. Victoria Levitt. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Levitt, there are a few other things that you should know about. Over the past several months, I've shared clinical trial outcomes and other news that show that a form of stem cell therapy called autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, can be an effective treatment for some people living with relapsing remitting MS. And the question that I've received at least 100 times by now is, what about stem cell therapy for people living with progressive MS? So I'm happy to share some encouraging news about that very subject. Brainstorm Cell Therapeutics reported positive results from a small open-label phase 2 clinical trial that tested Brainstorm's cell therapy called Neurone on 18 people with either primary progressive MS or secondary progressive MS. This stem cell therapy uses mesenchymal stem cells derived from the patient's own bone marrow. Now, these cells are harvested from the patient and then treated in the laboratory in a way that makes the stem cells secrete nerve growth factors. Then the stem cells are reintroduced into the patient's spinal fluid. Not only did this treatment appear to be safe, but Brainstorm reported positive benefits in cognition, vision, mobility, and other functions. Additionally, and importantly, biomarkers were detected suggesting nerve protection and reduced inflammation in the brain and spinal cord. This is encouraging news, and we'll look forward to seeing results from large clinical trials of Neurone as a potential mesenchymal stem cell therapy for people living with progressive MS. If you'd like to review the details of this clinical trial, you'll find a link to the company's announcement in today's show notes. For the first time ever, an immune-modulating antibody will be introduced by means of a nasal spray to treat a person with secondary progressive MS. Now, this antibody is more formally referred to as a fully human anti-CD3 monoclonal antibody, commercially known as foralumab, and it works by binding to the CD3 receptor on immune T cells to calm the immune response. In people living with MS, that immune response is what leads to demyelination. Now, this one-off treatment is being given after the FDA approved a request submitted under the Individual Patient Expanded Access Program. Now, this program is sometimes referred to as compassionate use, when an investigational treatment is administered outside of a clinical trial as a response to an immediately life-threatening condition or serious disease. Foralumab was originally developed as an oral treatment, and it was reformulated for delivery in a nasal spray by Dr. Howard Weiner, director of the Multiple Sclerosis Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. A Phase 1 clinical trial of Foralumab was completed, showing no safety issues associated with the therapy, and a Phase 2 clinical trial of nasally administered foralumab in progressive MS will get underway later this year. Meanwhile, the patient living with secondary progressive MS will begin 6 months of treatment with foralumab at Brigham and Women's Hospital in June. Foralumab is also being tested in other formulations to treat other conditions. In a clinical trial in Brazil, it was administered as a nasal spray to treat people with COVID-19 infections, and the clinical trial data show that it significantly reduced lung inflammation. Dr. Weiner is a pioneer in MS research and treatment, so we'll be watching for future announcements about the safety and efficacy of foralumab as a potential treatment for secondary progressive MS. Wyse Therapeutics is a developer of game-based digital therapies. Their research-based app, Personal Zen, is already available to iOS and Android users. The app is designed to help manage stress and anxiety while building resilience. And now the company has taken their core technology, their attention bias modification engine, and developed digital products to address three specific conditions: alcohol use disorder, multiple sclerosis-related anxiety, and perinatal anxiety. Now, attention bias modification works by shifting a person's focus on certain things, their so-called attention bias, away from factors that trigger stress and toward more positive things, giving people more cognitive control over their stress triggers. After successful proof-of-concept trials demonstrated efficacy in treating alcohol use disorder, MS-related anxiety, and perinatal anxiety, Wyse Therapeutics is seeking FDA approval for all three digital therapies. Reducing MS-related anxiety through a digital therapy that lives on your smartphone or tablet sounds like pretty good medicine. We'll be following this work as it makes its way through the FDA's approval process. Pharmaceutical company Sanofi Genzyme has launched a website to help recruit people living with MS for one of the company's clinical trials testing a disease-modifying therapy called tolebrutinib. The company is looking for men and women between the ages of 18 and 55 who've been diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS or primary progressive MS, or between the ages of 18 and 60 with a diagnosis of secondary progressive MS. Tolebrutinib is designed to reduce central nervous system inflammation by blocking the action of an enzyme called Bruton tyrosine kinase, or BTK. BTK plays an important role in the activity of B cells. And the clinical trials are looking to recruit 900 adults who have experienced at least one MS relapse in the last year, two or more relapses in the previous 2 years, or had an MRI exam that showed at least one new inflammatory brain lesion in the year prior to enrolling in the trial. The trials are taking place at more than 100 sites worldwide, and people interested in participating should visit mymstrials.com to learn more about the trials and take the pre-screener, which only takes about 2 minutes to complete. Progress in treating MS happens through participation in clinical research, so I hope you'll visit mymstrials.com to see if you might have a role to play in solving MS. You'll find a link to that website in today's show notes. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of a medical device called Portable Neuromodulation Stimulator, or PONS, as a short-term treatment for walking difficulties in people living with MS. PONS includes a mouthpiece, which is placed on the tongue and delivers mild electrical signals to the brain through two major cranial nerves. The mouthpiece is connected to a controller that is worn around the patient's neck, and by sending these electrical impulses, the device helps the brain rewire itself, a phenomenon known as neuroplasticity. In other words, working with a neurorehabilitation specialist, this mild electrical stimulation helps improve your ability to walk by changing the pathways that your brain uses when you walk. This device was approved for use in Canada last year, and the FDA based its approval on the findings from two small clinical trials that showed the device was safe and that it improved balance among the trial participants. We've talked a lot in today's episode about emerging and experimental treatments designed to, above all else, improve your quality of life, to make it easier to live your best life with MS. But a critically important component in determining your quality of life is managing MS-related cognitive issues. And that's something that isn't always addressed as part of a treatment plan, although it should be. My guest today is neuroscientist and neuropsychologist Dr. Victoria Levitt, and we're talking about maintaining brain health and preserving cognitive function for people living with MS. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Victoria Levitt. The National MS Society points out that more than half of all the people living with MS may develop some problems with cognition. And while experiencing cognitive decline can be challenging and frustrating, these kinds of changes can also be scary. Joining me to talk about MS-related cognitive dysfunction and some of the things that you can do to better manage cognitive changes and preserve healthy cognition is Dr. Victoria Levitt. Dr. Levitt is a neuroscientist and neuropsychologist at Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Her passion lies in identifying and understanding key biopsychosocial factors related to brain health and cognitive health in people with MS. Dr. Levitt has dedicated her research to developing evidence-based treatments to protect brain health, leveraging modifiable lifestyle factors, those factors that we have control over, like diet, exercise, sleep, mood, and social support. In 2019, Dr. Levitt launched eSupport Health, a digital health company that provides support groups along with web-based programs and workshops that are based on the empirical research conducted by Dr. Levitt's lab at Columbia. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Levitt.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure to be here.
What do we mean when we talk about cognitive function?
So I'm glad that you started off with that question because the simple answer is cognitive function is all of the mental operations that we engage in with our brains. But the more accurate answer is cognition is our thoughts, our ideas, our perspectives, our beliefs. It's our memories. It's who we are. Cognition defines our very relationship to the world. It frames our sense of identity. And for this reason, I think that it's something, when it's threatened, it's an extremely intimate and personal experience because it goes to the very core of who we are as human beings.
When we think about the cognitive functions that MS can impact, one thing that a lot of people worry about is intellect. So does MS typically impact intellect?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, by definition, no. Because by definition, the way we think about intelligence is as a stable lifetime trait. And so what that means is that I can measure your intelligence when you're five. And with a very, very high degree of certainty, I can project what your intelligence will be when you're in middle adulthood and in late adulthood. There can be fluctuations in various cognitive domains within your profile, but your intelligence is kind of a capacity that's almost genetically determined, actually. And there's, of course, huge arguments over this, but it's the fluctuations in things like memory and processing speed that I think we're going to talk about more in this interview that have specifically to do with folks with MS.
You know, I think that's really a fine point to keep in mind, especially for people who are perhaps living with a family member with MS, because if someone has MS and they're dealing with things like searching for the right word or maybe processing speed or even concentration issues, from the outside, that can look or sound like their intellect has been impacted, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Do people living with relapsing remitting MS experience cognitive dysfunction differently than people who are living with progressive MS?
So there's a complicated answer, and it has to do with all of the literature that's looked at this. Surely the further along people get in their disease course, the worse the cognition tends to look in general. But that can always be upended because, like everything in MS, it's all unpredictable. It all varies from person to person. So you can have somebody early on in the disease course experiencing cognitive symptoms as their primary symptom. You can have people very, very far along in secondary progressive MS. With very intact cognition. So it is hard to know. And also, John, I always like to mention that a lot of the research findings that I could refer to by way of answering this question may no longer be up to date because we're now in the DMT era, and that's changing a lot. It's not only changing the way that we control MS disease progression by slowing progression and stopping disease activity. It's having secondary effects on cognition. And that's something that we're actually starting to know now because these drug studies are starting to fold cognition in as a secondary outcome, which I think is really important and critical.
Wondering whether MS symptoms like fatigue or depression in particular, do they have an impact on cognition?
So they're certainly related. They're certainly a part of the big picture, the big pie. I like to separate out fatigue because it's really its own special animal and so complicated. But let's focus on mood for just a second, and let's bring in depression and anxiety because these are two things that not some people with MS experience, but most people with MS experience at some point. And actually, my lab looked at relationships of depression and anxiety to cognitive patterns, and we found, indeed, distinct patterns of cognitive changes related to one but not the other. And so being able to disentangle these kinds of things is one of the things that I think is most valuable about what neuropsychologists have to offer in the clinic, which is if we look at all these factors together, we can start to understand the patterns. And for me, one of the reasons that's so important is because we have treatments for depression and anxiety. So if that's at play, we definitely want to start looking at that because we can reasonably expect a beneficial effect for cognition.
What are some early signs of cognitive dysfunction, and what should someone do if they find that they're experiencing some of these signs?
So the early signs are pretty much going to be up to you to identify, right? They might be very subtle. I think that one of the things that's so pernicious about cognitive symptoms is they leave the person who's experiencing them wondering, like, is this real or is this in my head? And You know, I kind of think back to a parent-teacher conference I went to one time where the teacher stood up and said, you know what, if you think something might be going on with your kid, you should call me that day. Like, just call me. Don't wait around. And it just really resonated with me because I thought, I think so much in life, we sort of want to hope that what we're thinking may or may not be true and just push it away. I think this is the time to listen. If you think something's off, tell your doctor. Talk to your doctor about it. Find out what your options are. Knowledge is power. Knowledge gives us power. So don't bury your head in the sand. It is scary to confront, and it's brave to confront. But find out whether you can get that cognitive evaluation. At the very least, you'll have a baseline, and you'll have that as reassurance down the line, maybe in 10 years. You might find yourself wondering, have things changed? Well, go back to that person who saw you 10 years ago and find out.
When someone hears the term cognitive evaluation, that alone sometimes raises anxiety because we don't know enough about them, really. I'm wondering if you might shed some light on what that cognitive evaluation is about, what sort of questions get asked.
Yeah, it's a good question because people don't know what to expect. And the evaluation could range from 2 to 6 hours. I'm not really sure what others do, but I keep my evaluation to 2 hours because I don't want to torture people. And it is a lot to bite off. And it can be traumatizing, really, because, I mean, let's face it, as adults, how many of us have sat down and taken a paper and pencil test? I mean, in like the last decade or two or three. So having somebody do that, my first job is to put that person at ease. I like to explain at every step of the way what's happening. The first thing I'm going to do is an interview to gather all the information about the ancillary factors that can affect cognition that I want to have about you. So that's going to include your sleep habits, your diet habits, your exercise, your social support. It's going to include your mood. And then I'm going to get into the paper and pencil tests. And my job is to help you produce your optimal performance, not your person under pressure, terrified in a doctor's office performance, but just your everyday, this is how I function in the world performance, because I need to have as accurate a picture of you as I can get.
When I introduced you, I mentioned that you have a particular interest in the impact of modifiable lifestyle factors, things like diet, exercise, intellectually stimulating activities that go toward preserving healthy cognition. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So these factors kind of came about as part of the cognitive reserve hypothesis, which was developed in aging and Alzheimer's as a way of asking questions, framing questions. It's a theory. Cognitive reserve is the theory that we all have sort of a buffer that's built up over a lifetime that can protect us from age and disease-related cognitive decline. Now, it's a very hopeful and optimistic theory. And what we do is we test things like that we think might contribute to building our cognitive reserve over time. And those things have typically been those three that you mentioned: diet, exercise, intellectual enrichment. And indeed, we see good evidence for those contributing to cognitive reserve over the lifetime in aging and Alzheimer's, and now in MS as well, where we're doing more and more of this kind of research. But I've chosen to add a couple of other factors to that list. One of particular interest to me is social support. I think that as social animals, having the support of each other and being understood and feeling part of a community is so integral to who we are. And it's so closely tied to our brain health and our overall health that it's something that I'm adding to that list of modifiable lifestyle factors that we look at in relation to cognitive reserve.
When we're talking about intellectually stimulating activities, they can take many different forms. What about things like brain games or mobile apps? Are these things helpful in maintaining or enhancing brain health?
If you are subscribing to brain games and having fun doing them, I don't want to take that away from you. But I have not seen evidence supporting these kinds of things. And it's a question that comes up. It's a question that came up in our group last week at Columbia. We had a world-renowned researcher from Montreal giving us a talk, and somebody asked her that very question. And her answer was the same, which is, the evidence isn't there yet. So I worry about the vulnerability that we all have to be susceptible to these kinds of things, making these kinds of promises, because it does sound good. I mean, we all want to do something for our brains. But my advice is find something you love and engage in that as much as you can. And that's the best way to be healthy of mind, body, and soul.
This whole topic of cognitive decline, cognitive dysfunction, it's not always openly discussed at an appointment with an MS specialist. And so it sometimes gets overlooked and therefore never gets treated. We know when things don't get treated, most of the time they don't tend to improve on their own. So what's the best way for someone who may feel like they're experiencing some challenges when it comes to cognition? How do they start that conversation with their doctor, with their MS specialist?
Right. So first of all, just having awareness of it. And I think more and more people do now. I hear people talking about it, asking about it, my patients coming out and asking about it in the clinic. And I think many, many, many MS neurologists now have it on their radar. But if your neurologist isn't asking you about it, or your nurse practitioner, whomever you're seeing as your point of contact at the clinic, yes, you should bring it up and investigate it. It's something you want to really cross off the list. Just like everything else, you want to cover it. You want to be comprehensive. It can be daunting and terrifying to confront, but it is a piece that should be put in place so that at the very least you have a baseline. Don't worry about it for now. Maybe never worry about it, but it's there. It's like money in the bank.
When I introduced you, I also mentioned that you are the founder of eSupport Health. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Sure. Thanks for asking, John. In my research, as I said, I became more and more interested in social support as one of the factors contributing to brain health and overall health. And so I brought that question into the clinic and I started asking my patients themselves, how's your social support? And more often than not, I got an answer that was some variation of, my social support is great. You know, I have really supportive friends and family, but you know, nobody really understands what I'm going through. And I was struck by this. And the fact that as human beings, I think one of our greatest needs is to be understood, is to know that somebody gets it and knows what we're going through. That's why the best movies touch us, because we look up there on screen and we see something that makes us go, oh yeah, me too. We connect. We need to connect in a meaningful way with each other. And it broke my heart to hear patients say this, that they felt like nobody knew what they were going through. It also struck me as ridiculous because, well, guess what? My 10 a.m. patient just said the same thing. I think she understands something about what you're going through. And so what I started doing back in 2017 is bringing together groups of folks with MS in support groups online through Zoom links, which at that time was very unusual. Now, of course, Zoom rooms are like our own bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, and living room. But at the time, it was novel. And I thought that this delivery mechanism for providing something so important to people with MS was really meaningful. And I formed a company last year to continue to deliver these support groups, professionally moderated support groups to people with MS online, so that from the safety and privacy of their own homes, they could connect with other people who really understand what they're going through.
Well, how can our listeners find out more about what eSupport Health offers?
The website you can visit is www.esupporthealth.com. Come check it out. We're also offering free Wednesday workshops. We do that once a month. If you go to the website, you'll find information there about registering. It's free, but you need to register. And coming to that will just kind of give you more of a feeling for who we are and what we have and the things that we offer. In addition to the support groups for folks with MS themselves, John, I want to mention that we've recently started what we call eFamily, and that's for family members and loved ones of people with MS for whom we found there exist much fewer resources than there are for people with MS. And so we wanted to address that. So we now have those groups as well.
Well, as a former MS caregiver, I can certainly appreciate how important those are and how few opportunities there are to find those kinds of resources. So Dr. Victoria Levitt, thank you for all that you do to improve the quality of life for people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure being here.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/188. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. Just a quick reminder that if you haven't yet taken our first ever Real Talk MS listener survey, you still have time. Completing the survey will take you less than 7 minutes, but it will allow me to learn a little bit more about the Real Talk MS listener community and what you're looking for in this podcast. And you'll be entered into a drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. You'll find the survey at realtalkms.com/survey. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.